This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Booksplode, Namor Visionaries, John Byrne, Volume 1.
The continent of Atlantis was an island which lay before the Great Flood in the area we now call the Atlantic Ocean. So great an area of land that from her western shore.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Booksplode, Namor Visionaries, John Byrne, Volume 1. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I am here with Josh Flanagan.
Hey there.
And we're here to talk about our final Booksplode of the year, the aforementioned Namor Visionaries, John Byrne, Volume 1. There will be spoilers for this old book, so keep that in mind. And thank you to the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy. They're the ones who unlocked this Booksplode/Talksplode series that we do every other month. So thanks. We enjoy doing this quite a bit. It's fun.
Can I also add Imperius Rex?
Imperius Rex. So
same. Imperius Rex.
We were trying to figure out what we wanted to do for the final Booksplode of the year. We had another book we thought about doing. We decided not to do that one. But, you know, we were on a bit of a Namor kick. He was in the zeitgeist. He was in the culture. He was in the Black Panther movie. And we decided, I threw out the idea of doing the Namor the Submariner series that it came out in the 90s. I don't know, Josh, you probably never read it, right?
I read this as it came out.
Oh, you did? Okay. So
Yeah, absolutely.
I hadn't returned to it since then. So we said that might be fun. We love Namor. So, and John Byrne is a legend. So that's what we're doing. The Namor Visionaries, John Byrne Volume 1. That's such a long title. Series encompasses the first 9 issues of the Namor series, and if you are a Marvel Unlimited subscriber, all 25 issues are, nope, they're not all there, but the first 18 issues are on there. That'll get you through there.
What's that about? Should we finish them? Nah.
It probably depends on what files they've got on hand and things like that. So, let's talk about the background of the book before we get into the book itself. This book came out in 1990. We were in junior high school, and Josh and I, before the show, were just going through sort of the arc of John Byrne's mainstream career, and this is the very end of it. He, you know, obviously broke out with Uncanny X-Men in 1977. He did that for a few years. Then he went to Fantastic Four. Did that for 5 years. While he was doing that, he also did Alpha Flight, and then in 1985 he did She-Hulk, and then in 1986 he jumps over to DC. Does the Man of Steel miniseries that reintroduces Superman after Crisis on Infinite Earths. And then he does the Legends event, which is the first post-Crisis event at DC that sort of reestablishes the DC universe, introduces Wonder Woman, and introduces the Justice League International team and sort of sets that going. And then he does 2 years on Superman. And so he sort of lives in that world for two years or so. And then goes back to Marvel, does West Coast Avengers, and in 1989, and the next year, there was the debut of Namor, the Submariner. followed by Iron Man. And then after that, he goes to his creator-owned work and doesn't ever really return to his stature as one of the top artists in comics. So that's the sort of the arc of John Byrne's career. I was excited for Namor. I remember being excited for Namor. Do you remember at all how you felt at the time?
I knew John Byrne at the time. I would say I started reading comics, I think, 88 or so. Okay. And I probably read them for about, like, heavily for maybe about 3 years. So this would have been towards the end of it. And I know I did not finish this, but I know that I bought it when it came out. Because right. I knew more about John Byrne than I did Namor, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I had been reading She-Hulk. Was that before this? That's what you just said.
She-Hulk was before this, yeah.
Okay, so I had read through that, and I had read West Coast Avengers, and I recognized, like, oh, this guy is one of the great artists. So I was following the creator at age 12, 11, 13.
That's the same thought I just had while you were talking, was that this might have been the first instance of me purely following the creator. And I knew Namor. I'd been reading longer than you.
Right.
I was a fan of, I'd read Fantastic Four comics. I liked the character, but the reason I would have bought Namor of the Submariner book was because John Byrne was doing it. So that was probably the first time. I mean, as a kid, looking back, I mean, we've talked a lot over the years about our history of reading and our favorite artists and things like that. I mean, I obviously was a big fan of Kevin Maguire doing Justice League at that time, and I was a big fan of George Perez. But if you asked me who my favorite artist as a kid in the 80s while reading comics, it was certainly John Byrne. And so I was reading basically anything he was doing. And so I was like, oh, he's doing a Submariner Namor book. I'll read that. And that's almost exactly why I would have picked it up back then.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was between him and McFarlane. Those are the two that I followed back then.
And interestingly enough, if you look at the cover of the first issue, I mean, that's basically right out of Superman. And it's almost a mirror image of that famous shot of the final page of Man of Steel, of him flying out of the Kent's farm.
Yeah.
So I think that's very conscious. Fun fact, do you know who took over for John Byrne after he left this book? Because it kept going.
Eric Larson.
But someone not too far, someone who, as a, I would have been 12, but I would have been probably 14 when he took over. What made me go, ugh. And now I look back on that and laugh, and it was Jay Lee.
No kidding.
Jay Lee was the artist on Namor after John Byrne left.
I think I did know that. Like,
and it wasn't Jay Lee as you know him now. It
was Jay Lee as
sort of like a Jim Lee / Will Sportacio clone, which is what he was in the beginning.
Yeah. So Jay Lee then to Jay Lee now is like Gabriel Hardman now to Gordon Gekko then. Just a
right,
different person.
different beast. But I was, if John Byrne did it, I read it. So that's why I jumped in Namor. And it was really fun to go back and read this book. I know we've been talking lately on the Pick of the Week show about the different way comic book storytelling has evolved over the years, and why books don't feel like this anymore, and what does that exactly mean? Because I can't even really put my finger on it. But the idea of this ongoing story that felt like a soap opera, much more than it does now, because that's what comics always were. They were soap operas. It was the ABC plotline device, of structure, where you've got your A plot, your B plot, your C plot, the A plot wraps, B plot becomes A plot, C plot becomes B plot, and then there's a new C plot introduced, and it keeps going like that. That's how soap operas are written. That's how comics were written for a long time. And they're not anymore. But I enjoyed this because it never felt like I was starting and stopping, even though each issue almost had a different A plot. It was that there was this ongoing saga of him and these twins who were in the background, while still different threats and different characters almost every issue. I really like the structure of it.
It's very similar to the people from the Daredevil run recently, like the super rich people. Like, that's more heightened, but it's still like they're versus these people who are just rich people who are playing, which is very 80s to me. Like, they were, like, they've made all the money they were going to make, and now they would like to toy with people and win over and over again. But in this sort of superhero world, I mean, like, I had a lot of fun with it. I'm not gonna say it was my favorite thing, but because I had read it when I was a kid, but I didn't really remember it, but B, I remember not really, I remember wanting to like it a lot more than I liked it. I did not like it. I just, it didn't stick with me in any way other than looking at the art. And I think, I perhaps wasn't experienced or mature enough to really appreciate how ridiculous Namor is, you know, at that point. Because I do feel like Namor is, I feel like as a little kid, it's hard to get your head wrapped around what it is that's interesting or funny about that character.
Yeah, I mean, and he can be a lot of things, too.
I did like that. I thought the line here is that, because we've seen Namor as villain, we've seen Namor as hero. He's been an Avenger. He's been, you know, he's fought for us in World War II. He, you know, is a homewrecker. He is, you know, he's the enemy of the surface dwellers. We've seen all these things. And yeah. I like this version of it, where it's like a grudging acceptance that there are surface dwellers, but mm-hmm. he doesn't wish them all harm.
They're not all bad.
They're not all bad. He doesn't really like them as a group, but certain ones are okay. Yeah, and many of them, the comely females, he's not at all disinclined towards.
Some of the surface dwellers are bangable.
He really was into banging.
So what I liked about the cover of the first issue, first of all, Out of the Depths and Into the 90s is a great tagline. But if you look at the little corner box, the character box, he's in a suit, which is, you know, another sort of aspect of Namor is that he has this business. And that's kind of the primary thrust of this story, is Namor as businessman, which is an unusual take.
That is what I always think of when I think of these issues. But he actually appears in a suit very, very infrequently.
Well, it depends
like,
on what suit.
Certainly not
about.
In the first issue. Right. But, you know, like dressed up as there's a party. He's at the party in a tuxedo. Other than that, he's pretty
and
much.
In disguise.
Yeah. He's. Oh, yeah. The beard.
And somehow his hair, which it goes, oh, your hair's always slicked back. It's much longer than people realize. I was like, no, it's not that long. It's not that long. It would go down his neck if it was that long. So
it's true.
Starting off. And I tried to look this up, but I couldn't find it. It wasn't really important. It doesn't really matter. Is that everyone thinks Namor is dead because of a storyline happened previous to this book, and I couldn't find out what storyline that was. If you know, you can tell us, but it's not really a big deal. So everyone thinks he's dead. He's back. It doesn't say how or why. It doesn't matter at all. He's back. He pops out of the water with all confused and in Hawaii and stumbles upon, or not Hawaii, or it's just some island.
I was going to say, those look like Mayans to me, which is kind of...
Ironic.
The people that he fights in the beginning, they look exactly like the people who he's supposed to come from in Wakanda Forever. Also, I didn't notice that the page, the double page spread is almost the exact same shot as the cover.
Yeah.
But it's actually a little better because he comes out of the boat at the bottom. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
So then this father and daughter team who are out in the water, you know, sort of help him and rescue him and that they become supporting characters in this story. One of the things I thought was really funny was that, like, by issue 3, he and the daughter are, like, in love. And I was like, are they? Have we seen them spend more than 5 minutes together?
No, it really totally happened off screen. You're not wrong.
And so that's become sort of the family, is he's been revived. He's got this father-daughter who are, like, salvagers, and now he helps bring them in. He brings them into his corporation as an oracle. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then Namorita, his cousin, who is basically just Supergirl, becomes part of the team as well. So you've got this little like supporting cast group that runs throughout the nine issue run. While they're being tormented by this couple, kind of creepily are a couple.
Yeah.
The Mars is Desmond and Mark. What is her name? Margaret.
I'm looking at the page.
Phoebe.
It's weird.
Phoebe.
It is weird to read a page where a character doesn't say the other character's name from back then.
Desmond and Phoebe Mars, they're like this, you know, ultra-rich, ultra-creepy couple in New York who have decided they're going to, mess with this new company, Oracle and Namor, and they become the antagonists. And mostly because they're just bored and full of ennui. And the opening shot of Desmond is he's about to commit suicide with an antique revolver because he's bored.
That's a very good entrance. And then, like, what is great about these as villains is that they are, like, they're completely fucked up.
Yeah.
They have no motivation.
Or redeemable qualities.
No, right. They're chaos and ego. It almost seems as if, like, Phoebe's kind of fallen for Namor, but it's like Miss Tessmacher.
Right.
It's like she sees a good thing, and she's surrounded by bad things, but you don't really buy it, you know?
Right. I mean, there's certainly more good in her than her brother, who seems to be a total sociopath, psychopath.
Right, and he's also threatening her constantly. So she's
and he abuses her, he hits her a lot. And
yeah, that's a lot of that in here, which you don't see anymore.
Right. So then, you know, it makes sense that the Namor, you know, her, she's sent to go seduce Namor. She's kind of like, oh, this guy's actually kind of nice to me and doesn't hit me, so maybe I'll hang out with him. But it really is just a, you know, we don't get the in this particular volume, you don't get the resolution of the Mars story, but you do get a lot of adventures throughout New York. There's the Griffin in issue 2, which was a very cool sort of, you know, Byrne is from the Kirby school. We've talked about before, like, you can trace a lot of these artists, you know, on a through line, and big action, big brawny heroes. That's a, you know, it's a Kirby
set piece
situation. Yeah. So the Griffin's a great character for Byrne's art. It's this giant, you know, Griffin. And, that, you know, it was fun. You get these, you know, one or two issues of adventures with these characters. Fantastic Four show up, Iron Man shows up briefly. The Human Torch shows up. Was that it for Major?
I mean, I think it's interesting because if you were to tell me, like, hey, Josh, explain to me what the plot of this is. If you were to go buy this one volume there and it has these nine issues in it, what's the plot? Well, he comes out of the water after everybody thinks he's dead. Where was he? Why was he there? Who gives a shit? Right. He finds, he knows about many, many wrecks and scavengers in the ocean floor.
That's right.
And so he uses that money to purchase a corporation. I don't remember why he wanted to purchase the corporation.
I think it was really funny. Like, he was like, hold on 1 second. And he jumped in the water and came back with a giant crate full of jewels.
Yeah. So like he buys like basically a failing or defunct energy company, as far as I can tell. And they're like, they were polluters of his ocean realm.
Right.
And one of the things that they're working on is a gigantic submarine tanker, I believe.
Yes.
And
an underwater tanker so that they could more efficiently transport oil. So there was, they wouldn't be subject to conditions on the surface and storms and things. They could just do it in a giant submarine that was the size of 3 oil tankers. That's not going to be a problem.
And you're like, why would he do this? But he does say, I'm only going to let it go the once, and then we're going to get rid of it.
He's going to dry dock it. He's going to show it to the press, and then they're going to get rid of it.
Which I liked. I thought that was kind of an interesting way to go. Then, so you've got the other people. So that's as far as that got. Like, he started the company. Why he did it, what the goal was, I'm not sure yet.
Well, I mean, there was a lot, as there always is in these Namor, Aquaman, whatever books, a lot about environmental activism in these books, which is somewhat ahead of its time in the 80s.
Although, there was ecology stuff
in the
70s.
I'm just saying, in sort of a mass way. There was certainly Earth Day, and people, you know, were beginning to recycle in the 80s. But there was a lot here about how, you know, all the things that are happening on the surface that are destroying the not just the people of Atlantis, but also the wildlife, but I guess the fish. And
so the first bit is the Mars send the Griffin after him. The Griffin kidnaps the girl. He saves her. Then he's like, I love you. And she's like, I can't love you. I got to go somewhere. So she goes on a cruise with her uncle who had a heart attack when the Griffin attacked.
Yeah.
While they're on that cruise, another beast composed of garbage and waste from the ocean, sludge, S-L-U-J, he approaches New York. There is, prior to that, the submarine ruptures because of eco-terrorists, and he's almost drowned by oil.
Which was cool, I thought.
It was really cool. And the second half is better than the first half.
The idea of Namor being like a fish who would get suffocated by the oil, I was like, oh, shit. I don't remember that. And that's really an interesting concept.
But the oil is unrelated to Sludge, who also seems to be made of oil.
Sludge is made of garbage. He's like he's in the garbage pack, patch, which was still there in the 80s.
The squirrel's in the Pacific, though, not the Atlantic.
Well, maybe there's one in the Atlantic that
I'm
only
sure
Namor knows
I'm
about.
I'm sure there are. I really like the sludge thing. It turns out there was mad scientists, and they created a life form, but it turns out that there actually is a whole thing, which is also really fucked up. Like, I don't know. The stuff in here, I'm like, wow, they wouldn't do. We were talking about 80s comics and 90s comics.
They wouldn't do most of the stuff.
They wouldn't do most of this, and it wasn't like so terrible. Well, it was pretty terrible. And this really was for kids at the time, so I find that fascinating. Like, all comics are written, you know, all mainstream comics are pretty much written for adults now, but this shit is like psychosexual, messed up.
Well, that was kind of Burns. That was kind of Burns.
Yeah, no, totally. But it's sold.
I mean, I thought there was a fun, unrelenting pace to it.
Yes.
Where, you know, now where everything's written in five to six issue arcs, and you know the characters are sort of spend half their time in emotional torment about what they're going. This was just like an unrelenting barrage of crises that were thrown at Namor every issue. Of you can breathe now because you've defeated the Griffin. Well, now here's this tanker disaster where you get drowned in oil, and then you survive that. Oh, but now here's the sludge monster. Like, it was just never ending.
It felt like episodic television.
Right, the soap opera. Yeah,
and there was some carryover.
Sure.
You know, but you could hop on at any episode / issue, and you'd be just fine. Although you might want to find out what happens next week, as the issue ends.
Yeah, I mean, the carryover was the interpersonal stuff. It was the his romance out of nowhere with the woman who saved him. It was the villains, the Mars couple, and even a bit of the oil stuff carried over, and the company stuff carried over. But for the most part, the villains, you know, you'd come around for one or two issues. Yeah, at the party for the tanker where the oil spill happens, you had Reed and Stu Richards, and you had Tony Stark, so Iron Man and you know, Reed and Sue jump on, and he had done Fantastic Four just a few years earlier, so that was probably fun. And he did Iron Man right after Namor.
You know, I thought
that part was cool. It was interesting to see the idea that Reed had a limit, because he goes in and tries to catch all the oil in his body in like a pool, and at some point he's like, I'm stretched to the limit. Like, at that point, I guess he had limitations on his powers. And then if someone's like, well, couldn't Sue do this better? She could probably lift it out of the water with her, you know, power. But I thought that was fun to see them all sort of working together like that, especially since it's a love triangle situation.
One of the things I dug, actually, is that the other people just happened to be at the party. They didn't know he was there. It wasn't like now everybody knows each other all the time.
It was like a society affair, you know, like it was New York society. So Fantastic Four were there and Tony Stark were there. Of course they were.
This is how it used to always happen, but now it's, they all know each other. They're all, you know, there's no secrets about why they get together somewhere, but I love that idea that there was a New York who was like, whoa, Tony Stark's here, because nobody knew who Tony Stark was.
Right, because he was still the
bodyguard. Why nobody figured it out? Nobody figuring out Tony Stark is way dumber than nobody figuring Superman out, by the way, because it's always like, yeah, my bodyguard, you know,
right.
It's clearly, although I guess he could walk around next to him or whatever, but I liked that bit, that it was just like, you're here. And it wasn't just one, it was several. And that Namor was there in mufti, as it were, with his fantastic outfit. And then, you know, Namor gets his ankle wings cut off, which was
interesting. Yeah.
Was they cut off or were they?
Melted off in the sludge. They had to inject serum into the sludge monster to sort of disable it. And in doing so, since Namor's a mutant and the sludge monster was a mutant, this serum apparently counteracted the mutant powers, and apparently the wings were part of his mutant powers, so those sort of melt off his body, which was, you know, disturbing.
And then Namorita spends the rest of the time wondering, what if that happens to me? Not concerned about him. What if I also lose my ankle wings? By the way, if she's a mutant, she has exactly the same mutation? Whatever.
Doesn't matter. Yeah.
I heard them also mention at one point, they mentioned Atlantean eyebrows. I was like, that's why they look like that. And then you look at Namorita and she has them also. I hadn't noticed that, but she's got the big archy eyebrows, which always make them look like you're asking a question and then leaning forward. Yes.
And the final arc was, you know, there was a lot of body horror in this. It was sort of disturbing where they're facing this woman, what was her name? Headhunter. And, you know, it's revealed she's got all these heads on the wall. And she opens up the fake wall. You can see there's no bodies back there. And I was like, oh shit. Cause I remember moments and I remember imagery, but I didn't remember the details of the story. So I was going along for the ride on this like anybody else would be. And I remember the heads in the wall, but I didn't remember that they were actually not severed heads. Cause at one point the cliffhanger is that Namor's head's on the wall too. And I was like, well, shit. Like current 45-year-old reader, I was like, well, fuck, what's going to happen next?
How are you going to get out of this?
It worked. I thought, you know, I kind of wish it was just one volume. I would have liked to have read the whole 25. I know we couldn't have done 25 for the show, but I would like to have read all of them.
I was about to, like, move along to the next ones. In fact, I will. I'm planning on just going to keep in reading it, but I stopped before we got to it. But it really was that, and this is a benefit, not a drawback. This, you could just keep going with this. You know, like,
yeah, I mean,
like,
I'm looking ahead.
You're not going to get
Iron Fist and Skrulls and everything.
if you go and you pick this up, it's not you're not it's not going to finish at the end of it, which is what we're all very used to now.
Right.
So you're just going to jump in for a while, and this one actually does end, but if you were reading like, you know, a Thor comic, it would never end. But this one ended at 25. I love the solution to the headhunter's thing. She's white and pink and can't deal with light. None of that has anything to do with anything else. She's just, and she's some sort of corporate leader, and like, it's a lot of random things put together, but the solution to her thing is that, like, it's a mirror trick, which is why you can't see their body. And I was like, why would you need to put that in? Who's going to see that?
You wouldn't have to just don't show off their fake wall.
And then the other deal was that one of the stories is that she meets some corporate leader who's done everything and needs to do the next thing, and she agrees to help him. But at the end of a given amount of time, like the devil makes an agreement that then she gets his head. And I was like, why would anyone make that deal? What is the point of being a corporate success if you're then in gonna 5 years you have to lose your head?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. This is not a complaint.
People don't think ahead. I'm really bummed because I was looking ahead at the covers, and issue 12 is an Invaders reunion. I was like, oh man, I wish that was in this one.
Well, you can keep going.
I'm going to.
Yeah,
I'm trying to get to the front, so I could, because we should credit the entire team here, because it's mostly the same team throughout the book. It's not on here. Oh, it is on here. So it's John Byrne wrote and drew it, obviously. Oh, Bob Wiak did the first issue. He didn't keep inking it. Someone else I noticed was in the inker after that. Glynis Oliver was the colors. I remember that name from comics, and Ken Lopez was the letterer, and this was a Tom DeFalco. Well, he was the editor-in-chief at the time. Terry Cavanaugh was the editor on this.
Okay, so Wiacek inked through the first three, and then Byrne took over as inker. And it has long been an assertion of mine, and I still believe it, that John Byrne is almost always better when somebody else inks him. He inks himself too sketchy, I think. And when he puts a nice, clean Terry Austin line on it.
Maybe it was later that he started doing that. Because I didn't really notice it too much of a difference.
I noticed it a little. I saw it like after the fact that he was inking, and I was like, and I looked at the page. I was like, oh, I can see it. It's just, when I say it's worse or better, it's totally subjective. Like,
yeah, sure.
He's the artist. He can make it look exactly as he wants to. But I like it when the inking on him is super clean, which is what I think about what comics look like from this era. You know, like at the time, that was the first time that I saw Bill Sienkiewicz, and I was like, what is this awful crap? You know, that's like, the same that's thing. Not that's like what I was into back then.
Right, that's my Jay Lee reaction. I was like, what is happening? let's talk about Namor. We've talked about him a bunch in the comics lately and on the Wakanda Forever review. As you said in the beginning, this is like a fun Namor that exists in the middle of all the Namors, right? He's still he's the deposed king of Atlantis in this story. He's not in charge.
But he's cool with it. It's not like his mission here is to get back in charge.
Right.
I don't think.
No, and he, you know, exists on the surface world, sort of in tension with them, but he has friends there. He has people he is romantically involved with, but he's still at his heart is Namor. He's arrogant. He's confident. He walks around in his little green underwears, and the women love it. Let's be clear. Every woman he comes across is like, who's this hunk in the green trunks? and you know, this is a fun Namor. I like him as, I like all kinds of Namors. I like pure villain Namor, but I also like this kind of anti-hero. Like, this is like your prototypical anti-hero. He's not necessarily a bad guy, but he has his values, and they may run contrary to what our values are because he comes from a different place.
So and one of my favorite panels in the whole thing, which I think explains this and illustrates it, is that he saves some people on a dock. I don't remember if it's a helicopter crash or whatever, but he sees they need help and he's flying by and he's like, all right, I might as well help them. And he flies away and they yell, thanks, Namor. If there's anything we can do to repay you, and his thought balloon is unlikely, and he just flies away. Like, he doesn't care. He doesn't want anything from them. He doesn't respect them. But he's like, I did the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not evil. He does not wish them. He tried to help them, but you know, he does no respect.
Unlikely.
It's great.
I mean, it's fun. I mean, it's not like the best book in the world. I'm not going to tell everyone, oh, man, this is like a forgotten classic, but it's a solid Marvel comic from an era in which they did it, you know, better than anybody and had people like John Byrne.
And it's a great example.
Yeah.
It's a great example of that era, I think, and also sort of the tail end of it, because this is going to quickly turn into the first boom and bust.
Well, you know, look, this is, you know, people talk about 80s comics, 90s comics. This was technically a 90s comic, but it's still an 80s comic. I mean, you know, things don't change with the calendar page turn. Like fashion doesn't change when it becomes 1970. It's still the 60s fashion. This was still the tail end of the 80s way of making comics.
And over at the X-Men book right now, people are just getting to know Jim Lee, you know, and those guys who are all going to shake everything up and change it.
Yeah, I mean, they've been there for years. He came out in 87, right?
Yeah, but I mean, either way, like this is where the crossover is happening, which I like because it's just an interesting time.
Which is interesting because this is his way out. You know, this was sort of you know when this book starts, he's only around Marvel for 4 more years, and that's basically it for his mainstream career. He comes back for Spider-Man Chapter 1, but that was kind of a disaster, and then he doesn't really come back again.
He still got to do all 12.
This book starts his 13th year as a big deal comic book artist, which started in 1977 with the X-Men. And this is sort of the tail end of it.
I wonder if he made more money on X-Men.
Maybe.
Because of the way that things were going back then. Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet he did. He owned it. So that's like a different thing.
But it is interesting to see, like, to chart his career, because I hadn't really written it all out before to see sort of where it went and where it started and when it ended. And you know, it was sort of like an artist who was so important to my childhood comic book reading basically disappeared while we were in high school. And, you know, it's irrelevant. I mean, I read Next Men.
I was going to say, were you following that stuff?
I read Next Men. It was clearly a X-Men ripoff. I mean, it's in the fucking title. but, you know, it wasn't, and it had nudity and it was edgy, but, I didn't enjoy it as much.
I feel like he's one of those guys where there's characters like this certainly used to be more, is that some people are made to do stories, whether they're licensed or creator-owned, and some people are made to do creator-owned, and some people are just made to do the company work. And I think that he's a company work guy. Like he shined when he got to put his imprint on these characters that he knew really well and grew up with.
Well, honestly, like it's not any different than most of what came out of the original Image books, which is almost all the, not all of them, but almost all of them were basically just, here's what we did at Marvel, but just slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that was what Wildcats was. That's what Cyberforce was. That's what Youngblood was.
Uh-huh.
Not what Savage Dragon was and not what Shadowhawk was, but that for the most part, that's what it was. It would have been no different. It would not have been strange to see it alongside of Wildcats coming out from Image and, you know, during that time.
Mm-hmm. But, I just think of him, he wasn't old, but I think of him as an older generation of it, for whatever reason.
He's probably older than them. He's probably about 10 years older than they were.
Probably, right? But I mean, I guess my thing is, like, he clearly comes out of the Kirby era as opposed to a later era. You can tell in the work that he grew up with Stan and Jack's Marvel comics.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, Roy Thomas, you know, he's the next along the line. And he wrote and drew. I don't think anybody did that quite as well as him.
Not a ton.
I'm trying to think of another writer. I mean, Frank Miller, but he wasn't nearly as prolific.
Well, at that time, Frank Miller he's about to basically transfer entirely over to Dark Horse and do Sin City. So at the time, it was like they had Frank Miller doing Sin City, they had John Byrne doing Next Men, they had Mike Mignola doing Hellboy. And that was sort of, I want to say, more mature version of Image, but it was more like, it was a different kind of comics than Image was doing.
But Frank Miller wasn't doing like Workaday ongoings, Byrne's thing was. Right. Frank Miller went and he did a prestige project, which was self-contained. Byrne, like, did the mainstream ongoing in continuity long runs.
Right. Oh, for sure.
Writing and drawing, which is...
You did 5 years of Fantastic Four.
That's amazing. It's, you know, and it's like people talk about it still. Yeah. And you see those covers when you close your eyes, you know, and you think about it. Like, if you say to me, like, Fantastic Four, and I close my eyes, I'm going to think of a Kirby cover first, but after that, I'm going to think of a John Byrne cover. Like, mm-hmm. That's what it's going to be.
Yeah, those are his Fantastic Four and X-Men were his two longest runs. And X-Men wasn't as long as you think. It was only 4 years.
All right. And if I say X-Men to you, I say John Byrne X-Men to you, what do you see?
I see Wolverine coming out of the sewer.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
And then I also see Wolverine reading an issue of Penthouse with everyone else around as they look for a little girl.
13-year-old. His 13-year-old sidekick. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see this. I mean, at the tail end of his, he's still got it. I mean, this is still really well done from a craft standpoint. This is fun. It's well written. He's still got the art. It's big. It's bombastic. It's got action. It's got character stuff. I mean, he's still got it here.
Well, if there's really good page turns in this. So the one before Sludge shows up, the last thing is you see this gigantic garbage hand come up out of the water. Yes. It's huge because the scale of the character is massive. Yeah, and then as you come into the next issue, it's sort of Manhattan getting flooded in a couple of pages. So he's got that scale thing that I always like to talk about going really well. I think it would be great if more current comic book artists used this stuff. Not fully, but like incorporated some of it. Things got really cool for a while and they got design based and they got, I want to see more of this, you know, this Roland Emmerich kind of comic book paging, you know.
Tough because you have fewer pages than Byrne had to work with. So you don't, when's the last time you saw like a true splash page? It hardly ever happened anymore because they need that real estate for lots of panels. So like they don't get the ability to open with a splash page or close with a big splash page. Like it's very rare. It doesn't happen mm-hmm. nearly as much as that used to be the de rigueur thing was you open the book to the splash page. That's what it was called. It was a big image. So they don't have that anymore. And then when you're writing a five to six issue arc every time, it's a different pacing than this is. Yeah. This is a relentless issue to issue, as you said, episodic pacing that just doesn't work in the trade format the way it's written and drawn now.
Yeah. I think that this scratches the, you know, we've got the t-shirt, we've got the gosh, good old superheroes.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
This is it. This is like, well, what's gosh? What's good old superheroes? Here's this Namor series. this is what I'm talking about.
Right.
It's uncomfortable. It's bombastic. It's definitely of a different time. It's quite silly. There's no one, you know, he's following the Grant Morrison rule. We're not worrying about how they fueled up the giant underwater tanker submarine. Right. Like it's not an issue. Like how are they running this corporation if they're completely insane and he's beating up his sister? Not a problem.
Right. When did Namor fall in love with this woman? That doesn't matter.
Why does Namor want to run this corporation? It doesn't matter.
I think they probably said in the beginning. I don't remember.
Maybe, but it didn't stick.
Well, he's got all this money. He might as well. Oh, yeah. I'll be right back. Hold on. Comes back with a bunch of rubies, emeralds. I had a great time. I flew through this.
Yeah.
In a way, you think, oh, it's going to be 80s comics. It's going to take a while. You know, a lot of dialogue, a lot of pages. But no, I flew through it.
And it was like, yeah, I'll do one more. It really was.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Yeah. Because they're fun. The Marvel... they're written that way to get you to go, what's going to happen next? Because there's a big cliffhanger every time.
Oddly enough, the Marvel Unlimited app is really good to go to the next issue. You finish it and it flips over. Like, you want to read the next one now? And I was like, I do. It's very, it's very compelling in that way. It's done really well.
Yeah, it's harder to scroll through series, but like it was from an issue to issue basis, it was very easy to be like, oh yeah, I do want to read really one more. I got another 10
minutes. It's right there.
Yeah.
Like it's not, you don't have to buy it. If you've already got the subscription, you're good.
So yeah, I mean, Namor, Visionaries, John Byrne, Volume 1, super fun.
Are we supposed to rate these? I forget.
Sure, why not? Ratings out of 5. Ratings out of 5 stars. I'm giving it a solid 4.
Yeah, I was going to say 4.
It's a super fun book from a legitimate industry legend. One of the top, certainly top 10 most important people who worked in comics. He ruled an entire decade of the comics industry.
I know that it is unrealistic to expect that this would have been the Namor that showed up in the Wakanda Forever movie. No, he wouldn't have fit in, but is what I wanted. I don't think I wanted him in that, but that's what I was getting at. Like, I didn't want him in that movie. I wanted the cheapest possible TV show with this character.
Yeah.
Like, I would have been fine. Just a wet guy walking around in his panties.
It would have been funny if he was just always wet.
It would be good. Just drip, drip, drip.
There was also one of my favorite scenes in this book was when he was having a conversation with Nemorita while he was in the pool. Mm-hmm. And she just sort of got in her hands and knees and stuck her head in the water. And then there was an overhead shot of it. And it was just so bizarre looking. It was just fun. It was really fun.
I get the sense, and this is probably a John Byrne thing, but probably others too, is that I feel like a lot of this existed, elements of it and even larger pieces of it, because it amused him. And because of who he was, because of the way comics work, then he was able to do so. You know, like I'm going to put this weird, like, I'm guessing this book says a lot about him in ways that you do not know.
All of his work does, I think.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to think about, I don't know, rumors, whatever, but, you know, I understand him as being a bombastic personality. And it's like, well, who is better than Namor for this kind of thing?
Oh, perfect for him. Like, yeah.
Incredibly talented, you know, prolific, not super empathetic, perhaps, you know.
I am
great.
I certainly read a lot of the Fantastic Four books he did. I didn't read them all. I wasn't a regular collector of Fantastic Four. I mean, it started in 81. I was 4. But I talk a lot about wanting to reread Peter David's Hulk run, but I would love to just sit down and blow through his Fantastic Four run, John Byrne's, because I bet there's a lot of great Namor in there, too. And Doom.
I would want to read Yeah, no, it's exactly right. I would want to read Namor before I'd want to read the Hulk run. Or not Namor, Fantastic Four, I mean.
Sure.
Absolutely. 100%. Because I don't think I have read it. I can picture it. I can see it. He draws them perfectly. Like, that's what they should look like.
That's actually how I picture, like, in my head. And partially, yeah. No, not for sure. Not partially. That's exactly how I picture them in my head. You picture Fantastic Four in your head, I picture John Byrne's Fantastic Four.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, God, I've definitely read Man of Steel. I've read Legends. I've read Superman. I've read a good portion of West Coast Avengers. I read a good portion of She-Hulk. I don't think I read very much Alpha Flight, and I read a good portion of the X-Men. So I think really the big hole for me with Byrne is Fantastic Four.
You'd get one of them big books.
Get one of them big books. It's probably a John Byrne omnibus.
Yeah, it's probably all in this Marvel.
If I bring one more omnibus into this house, I'm going to get evicted.
I mean, the structural issues we're not even discussing.
If you hear any creaking, that's just from the omnibuses in the background. All right, so that was our final book spoiler of the year. Again, thanks to the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy who supported us throughout the year. They're the ones who unlocked the Booksplode Talksplode combo. We alternate months between the Talksplode interview show and the Booksplode review show when we talk about a collection like this. We'll be back in January with a new episode. And in the meantime, you can listen to our Pick of the Week show where Josh and I and sometimes special guests review the week's comics. We have our monthly Media Splode show that was also unlocked by the patrons that we talk about non-comics media. All kinds of fun stuff happening there. If you want to be a patron supporter, patreon.com/ifanboy. We thank you for doing that. And we'll be back next time with a book explode in February. Don't know what it'll be, but hopefully it's as fun as this one. Until then, I'm Connor.
I'm Josh. Thanks much. Also Imperious Rex.
Imperious Rex.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.